Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone in the literary world. My guest today is author Sheldon Green. Sheldon has just published an absolutely cracking novel, The Prodigal Sons. Sheldon, welcome to the program, and thank you for taking time out to talk with me today.
Well, thanks for giving me the opportunity.
Maybe we can start with a little background. Who is Sheldon Green?
I'll try to be short, because I got a long bio, but I'm a Midwesterner by birth and education, Pennsylvania and Ohio, and then a long time ago, a migrant to California, Berkeley specifically, and I'm a lawyer by trade, and in the financial institutions area, credit unions, as well as a history of doing a lot of public interest work and shaking the trees of guys like Ronald Reagan. And more recently, I'm in the wind energy business, have been for many years, and I do that parallel. And I kind of have a diversified approach to life. I'm singing the Oakland Symphony Chorus, do a lot of gardening, play a lot of tennis, as well as pursue these other activities.
You're a singer. What voice range do you
baritone?
Have? You're a baritone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, we got a concert Friday night, the opening of the Oakland Symphony concert series, and it's an opera series.
Wow, you certainly do seem to spread yourself around, shall we say?
Yeah, well, my philosophy is you only come this way once, and so might as well get your money's worth.
Absolutely. No, I love to talk to people that, you know, have a diverse set of interests. You know, so many people have this tunnel vision on life, and you're right. You know, it's you only come this way once. Might as well have fun while you're doing it.
Absolutely.
Prodigal Sons is actually your third novel, I believe. Do you find that each one becomes easier or more difficult to craft?
I think the challenges are really very diverse, and it depends upon the specific problem that you're solving. My approach to novel writing is kind of metamorphic. It starts with a germ, an idea, and then it kind of progresses. I mean, the last published novel took about 10 years to evolve. But to answer the question specifically, I think the longer you do this kind of thing, the more you develop the craft, so that the way I do it now is to have a very, very elaborate plot and outline. You know exactly where you're going from the beginning to the end. It's kind of the bones. The characters are fully realized in your head. And so to that extent, it does become easier, because when you know where you're going from chapter to chapter, then you really just have to rely on your craft as a writer of prose to make it happen.
I really enjoyed Prodigal Sons. I thought it was very, very well written. There's a great flow to it. You've got great character development and great plot lines. Are you pretty happy about the way it has gelled?
Yeah, I really am. And I'm very happy. The kind of responses I get from readers and reviewers is so gratifying. But obviously the challenge of writing about an assassin is to both present him in a way that people can be empathic and identify with him, rather than think he's some kind of a monster, And at the same time, the challenge of that is to present enough of his background, his motivation, and his emotions as he's going through the process of his life, so that people can be empathetic and understand that this is a human being who's a product of a very difficult life and is adapting in the best way he can.
Yes. In fact, I think I mentioned it in my review. You know, it's very hard to have your hero as an assassin. It's pretty tough to paint an assassin in a good light.
The people who, if you're going to appeal just to the assassins in the world, you have a fairly small readership.
Yes, exactly. I'm sure there is an online group out there somewhere, but
you're right.
you probably are limiting your sales potential somewhat.
Right.
But without giving away any spoilers, can you give us a thumbnail sketch of the plot?
Sure. The hero is a very kind of athletic guy, and he's educated in Germany originally, and his father similarly is educated in Germany, so he has a strong identification with Germany. But bottom line is he and his family are victims of the Holocaust and the Nazi assault on Jews. He also happens to be a Polish Jew, and so he adapts to these circumstances of World War II, and subsequently finds the better place for him to be is in Israel, because Poland is closed to him, even as a Jew. And so, having fought as a partisan, he fights in the War of Independence, and then returns to Germany to revenge his family, and then has a complicated circumstance, because he meets a solidly German woman, very beautiful, engaging classical pianist, and that further complicates his life, because he meets other people like him who fought on the other side but who have other agendas. So I think over that period of time, being who he is and who he is pretending to be, creates an awful lot of complication in his life that manages, I think, to unwind or resolve itself over the course of the book.
It's a fascinating plot line. You know, he really finds himself torn between Israel and Germany. And there's certainly a couple of passages in the book where, you know, he is thinking out loud, you know, should I go, should I stay, am I throwing away my real life for a false life? It's very deep and philosophical stuff.
Yeah, the big issue here is I'm dealing with the question of ideology. And essentially the message of the book is this is the end of ideology, or at least it should have been after World War II. And so he's caught in his own ideological background, and the Germans have their residual ideological background, and there's this big kind of conflict between the two of them. And the irony, of course, is that here's a guy who looks and behaves like your super Nordic hero, and yet he's a Jew, and which is complicating his life and complicating the perceptions that other people have of him in Germany. But the bottom line is that he has to kind of unload the ideology, just as other people in the book do, and then kind of function just on an interpersonal relationship with human to human, which brings in the second question, that for him, love is the redeeming element of kind of bringing him back to his his humanity, and it's a love that he develops for Greta, the other character. So that's kind of the polarity, the message, the polarity in it, that ideology sucks and love is supreme in creating a better world.
I really like that phrase. I'm going to have to remember it. Ideology sucks.
Yeah, that's West Coast lingo.
I know it's still early days, but you're getting pretty positive reader feedback.
Really, super. Yeah, I just love the reaction. I can tell you that for me, first of all, it's all about the writing process, and it's just great fun, and it really just taps all of my energy and my spirit to make something happen out of an idea. And then the second aspect of it is that once these characters are alive, and I mean they are alive for me, they just have to be exposed to other people outside of me. And so to the extent that the books are read and people get back and say, yeah, I really like these people, I like your story, etc., as you did, it just gives me enormous gratification. And I think if the characters who are kind of there, they've become realized in a way, in at least a idealized way, not walking around in the streets. If they were existing, kind of like Faust conjures people up, or the devil conjures people up, they'd, I think, be similarly gratified that people are reading their story and saying, hey, yeah, I understand you and I appreciate you.
I really enjoyed the plot line, and I have to admit that it's an arena that I just find fascinating. I think I first came across it in Frederick Forsyth. He kind of used it in his 72 book, The Odessa File. And then I came across it again from the real live version, ex-Mossad guy, Issa Harel.
Yeah, he is actually, big time.
He wrote a book called The House on Garibaldi Street, which is all about tracking down Eichmann. I mean, wonderful, wonderful stuff. Were these influences on you? Where did the idea for Prodigal Sons come from?
There's something separate than that. I read about a left-wing intellectual poet who was also a fighter in the Warsaw Ghetto, one of the few that survived, and then he went to Israel and was in a kibbutz, and after the war he brought a few people back to Germany on a clandestine mission to take revenge on Nazis that had fallen through the net that the Allies were casting on the Nazis after the war. So that idea really intrigued me, and that's really the nucleus of the book.
Do you remember the title of it? Because that does ring a vague and distant bell in my mind.
No, I don't think there was any title. I recall that he might have done a memoir, but I think it's relatively obscure. I turned it up, and then the idea began to flower.
While you don't push either the Odessa or Die Spinne, which is German for the spider, I do assume that you must have done some research on these organizations.
Yeah, I can tell you that the original concept, I mean, this is kind of a funny thing with writing, as I think you know. I had to have an organization a little bit like the Odessa, but different, because the agenda of Die Spinne is entirely different than what the Odessa people were doing. They were mainly getting SS people out of Germany and placing them in Uruguay and places like that with resources. So in any event, I had this circumstance, and I was looking for some validity of it. I got on the internet, and I actually found precisely what I had conjured up in my imagination. This Die Spinne, where these guys were funneling money and that was still left over from what the Nazis had salvaged, and funneling it through Switzerland, and then ultimately funneling it on to the Middle East, so to finish up what they had, you know, incompletely done with the Jews. I mean, they still saw their enemy as Israel, even though they respected Israel more than they respected the Jews before it occurred. But that's how the thing came about. It was quite remarkable.
That's amazing. Yeah. You have an idea, and then the facts fit.
Right. Well, it's kind of, you sometimes think, I sometimes think this, and I'm sure that writers think it, and journalists think it, that there's somehow or other, the antenna goes up and kind of turns around, and some information comes your way, and where does it come from? Out of the Ethernet that has not been passed on by Google, and then ultimately you go down to the Internet, and you find, in fact, that it's there.
Right. Have you yourself spent any time in Germany?
Yes. As a matter of fact, one of the reasons why you have a very faithful description of the Munich area, and specifically even the house that that is the in the plot that I won't describe, but in any event, yeah, we have very, very close friends in Munich. They're extended family, and so we've been there many times, and so I know the town, and I also have a very good sense of the culture, and the house, as I said, that that figures very strongly in the book is. We were staying there one time, and I said, "Hey, let's walk around and see if I can find a source, an exact house that's going to fit my bill for this component of the novel." And so we did. We wandered around and found this Jugendstil house, and I said, "There we go. That's it."
Actually, I spent a fair amount of time in Germany as a teenager. Munich is actually München, isn't it?
München.
München, yeah. Delightful, yeah. Delightful place.
It is. Yeah. It's a strange place, too, though, in terms of, as you know, the Nazi whole, the source of the Nazi government and the Nazi party was started out in Munich, and that's where Hitler, after, you know, stood up on the tables where everybody's drinking their steins of beer and started to mobilize his goofy troops.
Right. Actually, I'm just in the midst of reading another book, which happens to be on that very, very subject.
Hmm.
And like I said earlier, you know, it's one of those periods of history that I really, really am attracted to.
Yeah.
And I like it when an author, albeit it's novel, it's fiction, it does actually try and bring in some factual data. And indeed, you do that very well.
Well, thank you. Yeah, this is very heavily fact-based. Just about all the details that you find in the book have a factual basis. I mean, other than the journey of the hero and his infatuation and engagement with his with Greta. But and the other thing on that subject, I think that was advantageous to me in developing this was that I wanted the German guys on the other side of the tennis court net, you might say, to be fully realized human beings. And they may have had their quirks, they may have their predispositions, they may have their ideological residues, but they are really human beings. And so I tried to create people who were just as sympathetic as Horst is super sympathetic. So I think many of the books that deal with this subject, they tend to, the enemy is demonized. The enemy is always kind of two-dimensional. And I really didn't want that. I think, as you remember, Hannah Arendt, Jewish philosopher, talked about the, quote, banality of evil.
Right.
And I really wanted that also to be demonstrated in terms of the negative aspect of the guys that are running around doing their neo-Nazi thing.
On a philosophical note, or maybe it's hindsight being 2020, I'm 54 years old.
Congratulations.
Yeah, I'm getting old. But I was born after World War II, so wasn't there to witness it. Do you think we messed up after World War II by not doing more to eradicate organizations like the ADESA and Die Spinne? Or were we just all overwhelmed with trying to fix what was broken?
I think a little bit of both, but there are other dimensions to that. It's a really provocative question. The first thing I would say is that I think we did the best we could, the Allies, with the Nazis, but there were obviously people who were going to slip through the nets because the documentation, toward the end of the war, they were probably busy concealing an awful lot of information, especially the people who had the some of the heavy books, but who weren't as visible. They didn't have as much the celebrity status as the fat guy, you know, Goering, and the skinny guy, Goebbels, etc. So it was easy because of the magnitude of the problem of Nazis for a number of them just to kind of become anonymous and take on a different identities. And so I think we did the best we could with it. But there was another element of that is that the Cold War was beginning, and the Germans were saying to the Allies, and hey, you know, we got to finish the job. The real issue is get rid of communism. That's the evil that we were really confronting. So there was a lot of kind of complicity and ambivalence in our relationship to the Germans, and that was one of the reasons why an awful lot of Nazi types who had relatively clean records, at least as could be scrubbed, continued, and you found them everywhere in Germany. So that was another dimension of it. And I think we just did the best we could with it, and were compromised, as I said, by the Cold War emergence.
Is this a period of history that particularly attracts you?
Yeah, it is, because I mean, the whole issue of the Holocaust, and I guess in the context of Western civilization, is such a colossal paradox. And it's kind of incomprehensible that this could occur in the 20th century and that it could be a product of a whole state. But beyond that, I tell you, there's something that I've looked at the history of the United States since the World War II, and I would say that in many respects we lost World War II rather than won it. And that's not unusual. I mean, historians often say that the victors really are the losers in a war. And so why do I say that? Because it gave us this sense that we were the police force and we were the righteous in the world, and that somehow or other we had all of the answers. And then, of course, we had the Marshall Plan, so that tended to prove the fact that we really did have the right answer, because we rehabilitated Europe and we preserved Western democracy. But it gave us this sense that we had to do everything, so that then, I don't have to elaborate on it, we know where we've gone and where we've gone and where we've been recently, in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and we're a little bit like we've lost our momentum and lost our capacity and our perspective, and so it's really brought us down.
I think it's I would view it more as a loss of focus.
Certainly,
yeah.
That too.
Yeah, actually, it's interesting. About 3 weeks ago, I interviewed another author who had an interesting World War II tale, and I found out through interviewing him that he was one of the people that worked at Spandau with the last remaining prisoner.
Mm-hmm. Rudolf Hess or Rudolf Hess's substitute, whoever it was. Yeah.
Yeah. No, he was with Hess for a couple of years. Mm. The internet is an absolutely vital component to an author. Do you have a website?
Yeah, I do. It's sheldongreen.net, and just Sheldon Green without any interruptions. And there's stuff there. People could read a little bit more about me in depth and read a little bit more about the books that I've got published and some other ideas that I have. So sure, people are welcome to take a peek, see if there's anything there that interests them.
Where can people buy Prodigal Sons? Where would you direct them to?
The easiest place, of course, is Amazon, but it's also available through the conventional distributors that go to bookstores, but they're not apt to find it in bookstores. I mean, if they are wedded to bookstores, they should go, and I'm sure that the bookstores will get it through Ingram or from other international sources. But the simple thing to do is just to go to Amazon and punch in my name, Sheldon Green with the E on the end, and it'll come right to it.
I've talked to many authors, and I'm sure you know this story all too well. You know, the hard bit's writing the book. Wrong.
Yeah, the hard way is selling it.
Yeah, but
right.
Then the next stage is the hard bit is finding a publisher.
Right.
Wrong. The real hard bit is marketing it. What are you doing in the way of marketing?
That's a difficult question, and it's a really complicated question because in our celebrity-driven society, and where we have so much coming into our minds through the media, about the only way that you can effectively market a book, unless it is fortunate enough to catch some kind of an underground buzz surge that passes below the radar, so to speak, is for the large publishers to spend millions of dollars with big, big ads.
Right.
And certainly that's not within my interest or ability. So I'm just doing what authors do that don't have that that resource or that celebrity, and that's to get the book out and to try to spread it through various networks and see if it develops some kind of a buzz and some kind of momentum. I've tried actually speaking. I mean, the last book, I had an awful lot of book readings in bookstores, and if you don't have celebrity, it's just not going to produce a lot of people or a lot of activity. So I'm not quite sure what to do about that. But do you have any ideas other than getting it out through various sources like yours?
You know, I honestly don't. I think the ideal method is what is loosely referred to as viral marketing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the word of mouth, the men on the street.
Mm-hmm.
I think definitely having something like a blog, you know, is a useful tool.
Mm-hmm.
People get to meet the author, albeit vicariously. Yeah, they want to know that you had awful day. But, you know, you had to pull off the freeway and change your tire. I mean, it humanizes the author.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, nah. I really don't have much advice.
Well, you function on the internet, and it's what fascinates me is the incredible momentum that certain things happen to develop on YouTube. For example, the dowdy, frumpy lady that sings a song, and all of a sudden, a million people are looking at her. Or there are many other examples like that, and they're all kind of so peculiar and idiosyncratic. But the question that I have is, how is it that somehow or other something like that occurs and suddenly a million people are taking it in? And I guess it's the fact that it's not so much the blog, but people are more focused on looking at the visual dimension of the internet, so that perhaps just to speculate on the best thing to do would be to create some kind of a video that would be shockingly wild or and original, and then somehow or other somebody would look at it, and all of a sudden 100,000 people are looking at it. But that's beyond my speculation, even.
Right. I'll tell you my experience. That there seems to be little rhyme or reason as to what works and what doesn't work. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll give you a great example. About 3 years ago, we published an article, and I quite honestly wasn't that enthusiastic about it. It was an op-ed piece about fathers holding their daughters' hands, and that there was some obscure case that no one had ever heard of, where, you know, a father had been arrested for holding his young daughter's hand, you know, as they were walking around.
Wasn't in Iran or anything like that.
No, it was here in the U.S.
Yeah.
And I went, yeah, okay, so what? Yeah, we published, and that article received over 100,000 hits in 24 hours.
Wow.
Yeah, it made no sense.
Yeah.
And it still doesn't make any sense, and the article still gets hits.
Hmm. Well, what's remarkable about it is that the traction and where's the momentum? How does it happen? Because you'd think that the same number of people that are tuning into your internet source, there's not going to be a hundredfold or a thousandfold on that just because of the subject matter over a 24-hour period. It's incredible.
No,
it's as if there's something crawling around in the internet that suddenly is bringing to the attention of 2 million people who wouldn't otherwise have access to it.
Okay, I mean, the internet's much like fish in the ocean. You know, at the lowest level, you've got the plankton, you know, and things go up and up and up.
Mm-hmm.
This particular article got hit by a place called Dig, and once it hit Dig, it hit all of the other major aggregators.
I see.
Uh-huh. But there is no rhyme or reason to it.
Mm-hmm.
But let's change directions just for a moment, because time is getting a little short. What is it about lawyers and books? I swear that you're all closet authors. You know, I don't know how many lawyers I have interviewed who have books. What brought you into the industry?
Well, I started out actually, you know, it's a funny thing. I started writing fiction while I was in law school, and it was kind of an escape from the tedium of law. But I think that the psychology and the personality of lawyers adapts well to novel writing. I mean, first of all, a lot of lawyers have to be storytellers. They have to be, they really like to deal with facts and play around with them. Lawyers are communicators, many of them are verbally and in negotiation, in court, and they're also writers. And a lot of what we do is writing, briefs and letters, et cetera, et cetera. So it is kind of natural to take those, the interest that you, that a lawyer has in these skills and in sorting and embellishing facts, and then kind of transferring it to creating the a world that's more perfect than the world that they experience in life. I would say, just on that subject, I've often felt that novelists are kind of all would-be demigods. They'd like to create a world that, according to their own expectations and needs and intentions. So maybe lawyers are that way too. But in any event, I think that that's the other side of what makes a novelist.
You're in the San Francisco area, I think.
Yeah, right. Berkeley, okay, Berkeley, have an office in San Francisco.
Right. I used to live in lovely San Diego, mm-hmm. and I worked for a company that made sure that I spent, oh, a great deal of time every week on the road. I'm a computer geek, but I racked up more miles than the average trucker. And one of my favorite drives was actually from the Palm Springs area up into Riverside County. And right outside Palm Springs, there are these huge wind farms. Is that the kind of operation that you're involved in?
Yeah, right. It's Tehachapi, which is north of that, but it's still on the edge of the Mojave Desert, is the largest, was, I guess, pretty much the largest concentration of wind energy in the country. And that's where our facility is.
Is green the future of energy?
Definitely. Yeah, you have to recognize that solar and wind are renewable resources, but they're also intermittent resources. They're dependent on something that's free, but it's not there all the time. So if we could capitalize on that resource, we could provide all the energy for the country, even for the world. But what the thing that has to be done before that can happen is we have to develop superhighways all over the United States for energy, because our grid is not a national network at this point. And it has to be smart so that it's capable of storing and delivering as the demand fluctuates. And so we need to have different technology and storage to make it cost effective. But even without that, you will see that, say, in the next 10 years, 30% of our energy is going to come from renewable resources. Wind is right now the most economically viable one.
You mentioned the word storage, and that is problematic. I mean, mm-hmm. it's relatively easy to store gasoline. You know, you mm-hmm. put it in barrels, you put
it in...
Or even
natural gas, yeah.
Or even natural gas. Mm-hmm. But storing electric is a lot harder.
Yeah, it's kind of the philosopher's stone to the whole thing. I mean, that's going to... It's happening, and it will happen, but at this point, storage is transient, it's expensive, and it's not that efficient. But it's going to come. You'll see an awful lot of cars are going to just plug in at night, or even plug into a gas station and get a real quick fix to go on their merry way.
I mean, one of the big problems with electric cars is the amount of time it takes to recharge, and the batteries that are being used. Do you see some real breakthroughs, you know, on the horizon?
Oh yeah, there's an enormous amount of research that's focused on making batteries more efficient, quicker charge, greater retention of the energy, and more retention for the size. If you look at the computers, I mean, we're old enough to know what those enormous batteries of computers used to look like, a whole room full of them. And
I used to work with them.
Yeah, exactly. And so now you look at a desktop, or not even a desktop, a laptop, and it's the equivalent of that. So that's where it's going to go. I mean, but there are a lot of very, very difficult obstacles to be overcome in terms of making a storage, a battery, as efficient and as compact as it needs to be to do the things that it has to do, both with vehicles and with the storage of energy after its primary production.
I think what you're going to find is that a solution will be found, but it will start off horrendously expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And it is not until production ramps up that price drops. And
yeah, the economies of scale. Yeah, but first they've got to... The economies of scale are only going to be there if, in fact, production is going to be a factor of reducing the cost. But at this point, that's not the big issue. The big issue is increasing the efficiency of the storage media. And it's an enormous challenge. But I think the world will get there. Hopefully we here in the United States will have a lot of the significant achievements. But at this point, the state of research, I mean, the Japanese are going crazy with it, and the Chinese and the Germans, and so we don't have any monopoly on innovation anymore.
Unfortunately, my producer is whining in my ear.
Oh, yeah. Get him on the line.
it happens. Actually, it happens with almost every program I schedule. Sheldon,
I've got a lot of good ideas, and it's really enjoyable to talk with you. So I've really loved this 40 minutes or 30 minutes.
Sheldon, it has been delightful to talk to you. When can we expect the next book?
Actually, about a year from now. I've already contracted, and so I have to do probably some revisions, but it's pretty much ready to go. And you will certainly be one of the first to know about it.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. Sheldon, I have to say goodbye. My producer is going to murder me if I don't.
You need a good lawyer.
Yeah, right. I always need a good lawyer. This is Simon Barrett for Blogger News Network, wishing everyone a wonderful day. I'm sure we'll all talk again soon. My guest today was Sheldon Green, and he has a great book out. I do recommend that everyone aims their browser at Amazon.com and searches for Prodigal Sons by Sheldon Green with an E. Goodbye.
Bye.